U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
New York prosecutors indict the Trump Organization and its longtime accountant and CFO. Plus, the latest jobs report shows payrolls rising by 850,000 last month. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial board member Alicia Finley. On Thursday, New York prosecutors criminally charged the Trump Organization and its CFO, Alan Weisselberg, in an indictment with 15 counts, which include tax fraud, grand larceny, and falsifying business records. The indictment itself is only about 24 pages, double-spaced, if any listeners want to take 20 minutes and go give it a skim. Bill, you've taken a look at it. What does it say?
Well, there are 15 counts, but basically it boils down to this, two aspects. One is that the Trump Organization and its CFO, who is also named in the indictment, disguised about $1.7 million in compensation, employee compensation, as business expenses. In other words, they reported it in such a way that it didn't have to be reported as income and therefore evaded taxes. I think they say Mr. Weisselberg avoided about $900,000 in taxes. And then the second part of the counts relates to defrauding the New York State tax authorities, New York City tax authorities, and the IRS of the money that would have been due. So basically, it looks a lot like a civil case. It's sort of unusual to bring these charges criminally. But again, it boils down to a big dispute over business deductions, which the prosecutors claim is meant to be hiding income.
Yeah, the numbers as I see them are that he avoided paying taxes about $900,000 right. in taxes while taking about $133,000 in refunds. So that's about $1 million there. On the other hand, that's since, I think the indictment says since 2005.
Right.
But Alicia, so the leaks in advance of this indictment discussed it as sort of a fringe benefits case, you know, benefits provided to Weisselberg as part of his employment that were not reported to tax authorities. And there are two things in the indictment that I think challenge that narrative. The first is the specific nature of some of these benefits. I mean, you think of a company car maybe as a classic example of a fringe benefit. And that is in the indictment, Weisselberg's car, but it also says the Trump Organization paid for his wife's car, paid for new furniture and carpeting at his house in Florida, paid for private school tuition of his family members. And then there's some unreported cash allegedly for him to pay personal, the indictment says personal holiday gratuities. And so, Alicia, I'm no lawyer, but it seems to me that one of the difficulties he may have here is trying to justify those kinds of things as employment-related fringe benefits.
Right. So, I mean, some of these benefits, it's not uncommon in corporate America, and there's a lot of dispute about whether certain things should be considered fringe benefits and taxable. You know, it's still, you know, at the big tech companies, they provide meals, lunch and dinner for workers, and beyond the big tech companies as well. And so I think you're right that some of these things, it's very difficult to justify as a fringe benefit. But I do think that this just shows just how politically motivated it is, because usually the IRS or the Justice Department do not bring these kinds of cases. They settle them before they even go to a tax court, because it usually costs more to litigate the cases than they can actually, you know, actually make. So I do think that there will probably end up being a settlement rather than, I don't think this is going to be a clear victory of quote unquote tax fraud, especially on the larceny count.
The other issue I'd raise, Bill, in related to framing this as a fringe benefit case, is that the indictment alleges, if I'm reading it right, that there were essentially separate books kept by the Trump Organization tracking this stuff. So there's a section that says Weisselberg's authorized annual compensation was a fixed number. For example, from 2011 through 2018, it was $940,000. But then it says that the Trump Organization essentially kept track of these benefits and deducted it from that number. So Weisselberg received the benefits of these payments. The Trump Organization internally tracked and treated many of them as part of his authorized annual compensation. So, Bill, essentially what's alleged here is that they would pay him. They agreed to pay him $940,000, but then for the purposes of reporting his income, they would deduct all this stuff like his car and these tuition payments for his family members. And so for example, there's an AP story citing some tax experts, former prosecutors, saying that the case to them, having read the indictment, now looks stronger than the rumors about this just as a fringe benefits case. I don't know, but what do you make of that, Bill?
Yeah, I'm not that impressed by that, because I think that has to do with the word Trump. I'd like to know, for example, has the Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance ever brought a case like this in Manhattan before? Because I can believe that there are executives up and down Manhattan that have had similar issues about how they're reporting income and so forth. Look, it's not a nice thing to do if they've done it willfully and with the intent of defrauding the tax authorities. But it does seem to me that, you know, you're disagreeing about the categorization of income or a deduct, you know, whether it's income or whether it's a business deduction. And I think that that's best handled civilly. You know, find the money that if he's guilty, find the money that they owe and hit them with that plus a fine. To put this in the perspective of, you know, years of prosecutors going after Donald Trump and the Trump Organization, subpoenaing all kinds of records, including the president's tax records. And this is what they come up with. It seems like pretty small beer, given the effort that was put in. I mean, it seems like sort of an equivalent to the Mueller investigation. You know, all this storm and anxiety and all these predictions of these big things. And, you know, in this case, also Donald Trump isn't even mentioned. But the clear implication is one reason they're coming down hard on the CFO, Mr. Weisselberg, is they want him to flimp on Trump.
Yeah, Alicia, I mean, what do you make of this? The Journal's editorial on this says essentially that if this is true and it's willful, what's in the indictment, this is rotten behavior, it says, but it isn't teapot dome. So, I mean, how do you put this in context, Alicia, with, as Bill points out, the scale of this investigation, which has been running for years?
Right. So, Cyrus Vance, I mean, he went to the Supreme Court to seek to subpoena Trump's tax records, and he made all kinds of, in the subpoena, what they're looking for is, you know, whether there could be foreign collusion. The House committees, the Democrats also sought a lot of this information. And there are various, I shouldn't say conspiracy theories, but they made it out to be like, maybe he was, you know, putting money under the table to the Russians. And that there was, something a lot more nefarious going on than, you know, this garden variety misreporting of deductions or misreporting of income, which again is not unusual in corporate America, or for that matter, many pass-throughs, which is essentially why the Biden administration wants to ramp up the IRS enforcement of this kind of stuff.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Bill, I guess I agree with you that if this is all that results of this years long investigation, it looks to me also like pretty small beer. But how do you rate the chances that there are, you know, that the prosecutors here, they are trying to build a broader case. Whether or not that involves trying to flip Weisselberg, it remains to be seen. That seems a little unlikely to me. I mean, he's worked for the Trump since 1973, so he is kind of a lifer. But what do you rate the odds of another domino here falling?
I don't know. We've been promised a lot of dominoes over the years, right? And they don't seem to come. We were promised that in the Mueller report. I have a slightly different take. I think this is all about pressuring Mr. Weisselberg. You know, this guy is a 73-year-old accountant, and he was marched into court with handcuffs on. Really? Is he a threat? Is he going to overpower the guards or something? This is designed, I think, purely to intimidate and to try to get more information and information that's incriminating Donald Trump. And I don't know where that's going to go. I mean, I would have thought if they had more, they would have already brought it, but apparently not.
On the question of the political context, though, I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is some of the rhetoric, especially from New York Attorney General Letitia James, I think has been pretty undermining. So even in her victory speech running for the Attorney General's office in 2018, she specifically called out President Trump. And I'll read part of her quote. She says, "He should know that we here in New York, and I in particular, we are not scared of you. And as the next attorney general of his home state, I will be shining a bright light into every dark corner of his real estate dealings," unquote. And Alicia, to my eye, I mean, in retrospect, bringing this case now, she shouldn't have said that. It's corrosive to the case that's now been brought.
Right. I mean, it kind of reeks of a selective prosecution, like when prosecutors decide pick the target and then search for a crime. And again, I think this goes back to why you don't want to give the IRS more documents from individuals. It's because that just invites more fishing expeditions into political targets.
But the challenge here, Bill, is that she was running for elected office. And this is always, it seems to me, a potential danger when you have elected prosecutors and people who are in the public eye who are unpopular, and especially in a certain state, if it's politics, it's a red state versus blue state thing. But the danger of having elected prosecutors who think they can, you know, get votes by promising to go after certain people, Bill, is one that, you know, it's something everybody should be aware of and watch out for and try to avoid, I think.
Yeah, Kyle, you're absolutely right. Look, we're talking about two Democrats, Cy Vance and Letitia James, who made clear that they were after Trump. Letitia James campaigned on it, as you said, confirmed that this was her purpose when she went in. Now, let's be fair and note that Donald Trump, you know, talked about that with Mrs. Clinton. And, you know, at the Wall Street Journal, we kind of dinged him for that. You know, like you don't really go after defeated opponents, right? That's kind of a banana republic thing too. So it was not good when President Trump was implying that, wanted his attorney general to go after Hillary Clinton, who had been defeated. And it's not good, I think, or healthy, as you said, for the body politic, for state prosecutors now to be trying to go after another candidate after he's lost. You know, there's a trade-off, and maybe they do get away. I think Mrs. Clinton got away with murder in hiding her emails and destroying things. But I'm not sure that it was worth it to prosecute her once the American public made its decision to defeat her. And I think this, you could argue the same for Donald Trump. It's a bad precedent. And who knows, you know, with this precedent, if some red state prosecutors are going to find some things to go after Joe Biden or Kamala Harris.
Finally, last week we got some new jobs numbers. Employment last month was up 850,000, but also the unemployment rate ticked up by 0.1%. So, Alicia, how do you make sense of this latest jobs report?
Well, I think one issue is that the household survey and the establishment survey of employers don't always align, and they often don't. One reason in this case could be just the seasonal adjustments that have been skewed by the pandemic. And another reason is there has been a big increase in part-time work and a decline in self-reported employment. And those are kinds of could be gig jobs. You know, these differences kind of tend to realign over time. But I wouldn't read too much into the jobs report one way or the other. I mean, what we're hearing in this case, the anecdotes may be more important than the data. And what we're hearing is that businesses everywhere are really struggling to hire workers, and which is driving up wages. And Democrats tout that, but that's also putting inflationary pressure, but also hard for businesses. I mean, if you look at the how much leisure and hospitality workers got basically a 28% year over pay raise, which is just stunning.
Yeah, I mean, the political context is interesting. So Biden is taking credit for that 850,000 new jobs number. Here's part of what he said. None of this happened by accident. It's a direct result of the American Rescue Plan, unquote. But Bill, we're still in this strange situation where the headline unemployment number is still about 7 million lower than it was in February 2020 when COVID started to hit in the U.S. And yet the Labor Department's reports are showing that there are 9.3 million job openings. And so there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect in the labor market here.
Yeah, there is. And that's why some of these governors are trying to end the unemployment benefits early. Look, there's nothing unusual about a president taking credit for the economy performing under his watch. I mean, the true answer is that the best tonic for the best tonic for unemployment, for everything, is a recovering economy. And I think that it was doing that nicely before Joe Biden got in. And if anything, I think the spending is going to inhibit some of it and the extended unemployment benefits that follow. So we're a long way from normal, but it's certainly good for workers that there are more jobs than there seem to be workers applying for them. I mean, that's a good position for someone seeking work to be in.
Alicia, do we have evidence in yet on these states that have decided to end, stop giving out their part of the $300 weekly unemployment boost? I think there's about 26 states now that either have done so or have said they will soon. Do we have data yet comparing how they're faring against states that are still giving out that boost?
So, yeah, you said 26 states. So the difficulty is that very few, actually, most of them have ended the unemployment benefits within the last week and a half. So we don't have too much data. But from the initial data of, you know, benefits that were ended in May or mid-June, we are seeing that the states that ended the benefits then had a roughly 13.8% decline in payouts, versus a 5.7% decline in states that don't plan to end them until September. I mean, some of this economists wouldn't use the term, you know, there's an endogeneity effect in terms of the states that have ended the unemployment benefits have also eased their lockdowns earlier and also just are growing much faster than the states that haven't. And, you know, this is kind of a red states versus blue states. But I think there's no question that we're going to see in the next coming weeks more of an effect, and we will then get more data to push back against the left's narrative that, no, the unemployment benefits aren't having effect. No, I think we will definitely see, as the unemployment benefit claims, you know, trickle in and slow down in these states like Texas, Florida, and Arizona that are the bigger states that are ending the unemployment benefits earlier, you're going to see a bigger effect.
Yeah, on this point, there's a Journal News article that I think is worth a read, and the headline is Americans are leaving unemployment rolls more quickly in states cutting off benefits. And it discusses in particular Missouri and says that there are four more states that will curtail these extra unemployment benefits by July 10th. So maybe in the next jobs report, we will be able to discern more of the difference here. But Bill, I also wonder whether any of the states that are still doing so are starting to look at this data, and the governors are saying maybe we should join that list of 26 states, because according to the rules of the federal program, I think that money is supposed to last through September.
Right. It's supposed to expire in early September, so there's not much time for them. Look, this is why we have a federalist system, to let different states reach different opinions, different conclusions, different actions to reflect their local circumstances. And I think one reason this is so opposed in Washington is that the progressive answer is always one size fits all imposed on the nation. And I think one reason they're for that is they're afraid that it would show that these states had greater success, and they don't want to do that. They want everyone in the same boat because, you know, they're big on pushing the benefits and so forth. And so if the other states show a better record and get their economies running up to full speed faster and get more people off the unemployed rolls, that kind of questions some of those benefits that were put in the first place.
Well, Alicia, we'll give you the last word here. I mean, how do you size up the overall economic situation right now, the recovery that we're in, and particularly Joe Biden's claim that all the good news is based on his latest stimulus package, his latest COVID relief package that passed? I mean, how do you grade that claim?
I mean, I agree there again with Bill, what Bill said earlier. You know, the economy was already set to explode in March before they passed this bill. And I think that was one of the impetuses to accelerate it, because the Democrats wanted to be able to claim credit. And they were worried that as the economy improved, there would be less impetus to pass the $1.9 trillion bill. But I also think that, you know, it's, you know, to some extent, it's fed into inflationary pressures in terms, because people have gotten these stimulus checks, more money than they're going out and spending. And this is contributing to higher prices. But I also think, on the other hand, right, the unemployment benefits have provided a disincentive to work. So a labor shortage, which is, again, feeding into the inflationary pressures we're seeing. So to the extent that the government has given people money, it's also essentially taken money away from them through inflation.
All right. We'll leave it there for today. Thank you, Bill and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.